Bluemakers Podcast by MyraBase.com with Orsha Büyütem. Hey, hey, again. This is the 8th episode, and it was quite an interesting discussion with George Strickland from Toronto, Canada. He's an executive director member at the Circular Economy Club in North America. And he is working in sustainable building field. And I really liked the way how he saw the sustainable transition, because he says that it's important to think and design in a system to see not just the materials, but the use of a product or a building. He shared with me exciting ideas and platforms that I truly recommend you to check, like the Circular Economy Club, which has a free membership for everybody. There you can talk with people who are also passionate about circularity, and share your ideas or ask for feedback regarding your circular plans. And another thing what he recommended me, the asknature.org. It's about biomimicry in a very simple way. You can type anything regarding replicating nature in businesses or daily activities, or how to imitate nature in your activities. And also I really liked the way how he talked about nature and biomimicry, like the elegance of a tree and the way how we don't respect it and how we can respect it and use it. So I hope you will enjoy this podcast, and if do you have further questions or any feedback, please feel free to share it with me. You can send me a voice message through Anchor app, and also write me a mail or something. And yeah, so let's start the discussion.
So my name's George Strickland. And I'm Canadian. I grew up in Montreal in the French part of Canada, and now I live in Toronto, which is the major city in Canada. And it's frankly a major center of business in North America. It's quite booming these days with the building industry, and that's how I kind of came into this world of sustainability and green. It's really through the building industry, which I've been in pretty well most of my career, I would say. And it's from the aspect more of supplying materials to projects is my contribution really to the building projects. And it was in the early 2000s when this whole green building movement started. And in the United States, they started a green building council, which then came into Canada. And then we had the Canadian Green Building Council. And there was a certification that they had for professionals that wanted to be to participate in this field, called LEED. And LEED is spelled L-E-E-D, and it stands for Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. And so this program started in the U.S., came to Canada, but it's actually worldwide now. It's all throughout Europe, throughout the world, in fact. And so what that gave me an opportunity to do was to participate in building projects where they wanted to achieve these goals of LEED design. And so I sat in on a lot of projects, and I started to get very excited about the potential to do better. And really, more than that, it's kind of a thought process that you get to learn, which is a systemic thinking, an approach to solving problems, really, which was great. And that's really what's kind of brought me helped me to evolve really into this new category of sustainability, which now is being called circular economy. And circular economy, the definition of that really is a systems approach to economic development. So it was a perfect transition for me learning about systems thinking and systems approaches in building, and that now to be working more generally as a generalist in this world of circular economy.
Wow, it's nice. And how did you meet with sustainability? How this story start in your life? What was the first step, what you did regarding sustainability, or why did you choose to work in this field?
Yeah, it was actually in business while I was in business and working for a company that supplied products and systems to buildings, and I got my LEED accreditation for that, and again, I think it was you know, sitting in on these projects and listening to how it was really simple to practice this, you know, being sustainable and working with a sustainable approach. And yet, in fact, architects and engineers and that, they all learn this in school, actually. They're taught to approach a project and think about it more as a system. But then once they get into the real world, and they just start working with their traditional methods that have been practiced since the beginning, and everyone's working in their own little silos, and then usually they tend to have their own notions of what they want to do with their sections of the building, and then when they come to sit down, they don't always work together. And that's why you get kind of these conflicts happening, and they realize, wow, we should have talked about this earlier, you know, how we should have approached this. So I think that's really where the moment where I thought, hey, this is really simple to do. It's simple stuff, but I think it's all about humans and nature, you know, about change. Change is not easy, and everyone likes to do what they're, you know, work in their comfort zone, I would say. And then, so when you're coming out of school as an architect and you're ready to go, you know, you have the right thoughts and the way of working, but then when you actually get to work with your colleagues in the office, you see that they're working like the old traditional way, right?
Yeah.
And for you to try to change that, it's like kind of like a snowball going up a hill. It's not easy. So when I say snow to you, there's snow in your area too, right? It's not just Canada.
Yes, right.
Right. So I think that's really how I came to be involved in this area.
Yes. You mentioned that thinking in a system is important. I'm curious, what does it mean actually for you? How we can imagine system thinking?
Right. So if we think about a building and the process of designing a building, the end goal of this systems approach would be that you want to have a building that's designed for durability, it lasts a long time, and that you pose a question to yourself at the beginning, and you say, what's next with this building, right? What's going to happen to it at the end of its useful life? Everyone uses, you know, the term life cycle and that, and we tend to give life to inanimate objects, but that's just the way we think. But so at the end of the useful term of a building, there should be thought given in the beginning to what it's going to become, not just that it's going to be taken down and used for another building. I mean, that's such a huge waste. So really what we're trying to do is kind of what nature, we're trying to replicate nature, and in nature there's no waste.
Exactly.
Everything has a purpose, right?
Right.
And if there is something which we call waste, it's really more of a resource for something else. So this whole systems approach is thinking about what's next for that object or for that building. But then also, so when you're designing it, with a process that looks at things as a whole, and that they operate as a system too. So for example, when you're looking at the glass or the windows that are going into the building, how are these going to be replaced? So the building is going to last, I don't know, 100 years, but the windows might only last, I don't know, 15, 20 years, whatever. And then you might have, the fact is that, you know, because of technology, there's so many improvements. So you want to maybe replace some glass because it's not performing as well as something now that you have on the market. But then if you didn't give good thought to, well, how does that glass get replaced? How does it get removed? Is it easy to remove? So that's kind of all of the thinking that goes into it, just to, so that the building performs optimally. And really, when you think about it, we're doing this for ourselves because people live in buildings. So it all has to be with the thought of people inside. Is this going to be a comfortable building to work or to live in for the whole time too? Right. And we're not going to be just, in a lot of buildings today, we see a lot of glass, which is beautiful. And architects love working with it, but it's very exciting when you walk into an apartment or into a new office and you see all of this glass and you can see everywhere. But it's nice aesthetically, but from a performance standpoint, when you have people sitting on the south side that are facing the sun, and then you have people on the opposite side, on the north side, they have to put their sweaters on because they're cold, right?
Right.
So was that how, so you have to think about, well, so what happened to the thinking, the systemic thinking in that project, so that this person on one side, they might even be getting too hot because of the sun. And this is in the wintertime in Toronto. They have the air conditioning on because there's so much sun coming in the glass, right? And yet on the other side of the building, everyone's putting their sweaters on, you know, and they're sitting, you know, at their desk kind of shivering. So that's that kind of illustrates, I guess, kind of the thinking that goes into it, but then some of the problems that you might see that could arise.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think, based on your experience, what makes a building truly sustainable?
Right. So that's a great question because that the thinking behind that has changed so much. Like when I first got into the green building movement, having a sustainable building meant mostly how it performed from an energy standpoint, and if it was comfortable for the occupants. And when you're doing LEED projects and you get a rating for your building, you get a scorecard, and the buildings that would have a better energy performance would have a better scorecard. But today, that now we're broadening that thinking that we really need to be thinking about it. If we think about it within a circular economy approach, one of the main things about the circular economy approach is you want to think local more, so that it's where your supply chain is, that it's more local. You're benefiting the people more locally, so there's a societal benefit too that you want to support your local suppliers as much as you can. Now, this is a huge challenge because we've broadened, we've gone so global with our supply chains today. I know yesterday my wife and I were our coffee machine stopped working, so we had to replace it, and I was the first thing I'm thinking about when I go into the store, can I buy a coffee pot that's made in Canada? And I'm looking at all the different brands, and sure enough, it's all made in China. So I
Wow.
really didn't have a choice. So coming back to to the building project, so we really need to try to purchase locally, but if you can't find it, you have to try to develop that business. So it could be a longer term process, but and so many projects are based on the budget and pricing. So if we bought something local, that's going to go over the budget. So we better go to Asia to get the product because it's cheaper, right? It falls under the price, but I think we have to get beyond this whole budgeting exercise, and frankly, economic development and the economies of countries are based on exporting and importing so much. This is a whole function that we're going to have to try to get away from because it's just it's harming. The way things are working today.
It's quite interesting how the economy works. I mean, imported products are cheaper than the local available resources or products, and I think it's not the best way how we use our things.
No, it's not. And I mean, I think here in North America, we're probably the top consumers in the world. In the US and in Canada, we buy so much stuff, it's crazy. And we've gotten into the habit of not only a lot of stuff, but cheap stuff and stuff that we replace quickly. Like if my coffee machine gets broken, I'll buy another cheap one and it lasts only a year, so I just throw it out. That's the problem right there. And Americans took their manufacturing business and they took it over to Asia and to China and that so that they could produce things cheaply and then import them. But today now they're all crying because they don't have manufacturing. The reason they don't have manufacturing is because they sent their manufacturing over to China so that they could produce the goods that they designed, like the Apple phone. They designed that in the United States. Why didn't they produce it in the United States? They took it, they went over to China to get it produced. right? So that's a whole thinking that we have to get away from in the future. It's not, if that, see, that is not a sustainable approach or design for the future that way.
Yes. We spoke about designing in a system and sustainable approaches. But I'm also curious about what defines a material to be sustainable for buildings. What is your perspective about it?
Right. So so for sustainable materials, again, that whole category has transitioned over the years. From when I first became a lead professional, a product was considered sustainable if it was not as, let's say, hazardous as the one before it. For example, paints. The paints that were used in these lead projects, you had to use ones that didn't have what they called VOCs in them, which are volatile organic compounds. But these are the things that, let's just say you were painting your baby's, a new baby's room, and you want it to be as healthy an environment as possible. Some nice sunlight and nice natural ventilation. But then you paint on the wall with the old paints that have lead in them and so on, and all other kinds of chemicals, and these things can leach out, and it's not the most positive environment for a young person. So that was the thinking originally. But today, sustainable materials, we have to come back to, you know, with the circular approach, and it's local. So now again, you want to have something local. That's step number one. And then I think the rest of it is mostly about durability. How durable is your product made? And also, again, we come back to that question, what's next? What happens at the end of useful life of this product? Has it been designed properly so that you can repair it, so that you can deconstruct it and then make it again with relatively the same resources? Because the problem is we're running out of our natural resources, right? All of these metals and minerals that we use on a daily basis and to manufacture millions of types of materials and products. I mean, like, you know, copper and, you know, lithium for batteries and that. I mean, there's a finite number of years, you know, 10, 15, 20 years of supply that we have left. You know, that's just an example, a small example. So that's why that's the importance of durability. So we have to extend the life, number one. The second thing is about the way it's designed. Design is so important that I've learned, because when you are, if you're a designer, and I like to talk to designers these days about how they work, because it's really the intentionality, the intent. How do you intend for that product to work, and how do you intend for that product to live, and what happens to it at the end of its life? So as designers, when you are designing something for a certain purpose, now you can do it with an intentionality that gives you all of that durability, deconstruction, remanufacturing, all of that. So that to me is how we approach sustainability for materials.
What did you mean, replicating nature? What does it mean? How we can imagine it?
So this is very exciting. This is the most exciting thing that I'm involved in today. It's been said that we are currently in a time when so this science is called biomimicry or biomimetics, which is the science of mimicking nature, what happens in nature, and how we humans can take advantage of that. And so it's been said that today we are at the same point in time as the information age, like AI, it was 50 years ago. So think about, well, I mean, you can't think about 50 years ago, but when I was a young man, you know, computers and that whole, the computer age was just getting started, and, you know, digital and everything. They say that this biomimetics is at that stage today. So we are just on the verge of this starting to take off. So we have all kinds of universities, schools that are studying this, and they have students doing projects on this, and industry collaborating with students, just designing, and in the lab they're developing the ways to, like, for example, plastic, you know, is made from oil, really. So when we take oil, we create these polymers that are synthetic from the oil. But we know that that's not a good thing. We have to stop. So in labs today, they're looking for ways to design natural polymers. So a polymer, it's not only for a plastic bottle, but like even for your clothes. So if you have a polyester shirt on, that's made synthetically from oil with those polymers. But today, with biomimicry and so on, we're looking at ways to create these types of natural polymers, and the way that they would do it in nature. You know, there's something that you can do online. Anyone can do it. There's something called Ask Nature. And it's part of, I think, a biomimicry site. So, you know, it's from kids to adults to anyone interested. You can come up with any kind of problem that you have, and you can type it into this website, Ask Nature, and it will give you, it might not give you the direct answer, but it's going to give you all kinds of reference materials that you can start on your journey and start investigating this and start getting excited about this whole area of research. So again, it's this is something that I'm actively working on, even in Canada, is working with industry and making collaborations with the universities and with research centers that are taking advantage of this biomimicry and this biomimetics practice.
I think it's very important what you do to make a connection between the economic and the education system. And because I saw that, for example, in my country, this relation between the economic and the education system is not the best. And the result is awful. There are students with potential, but they can't apply relevant knowledge after when they finish the university in their works. And it's I think it would be the first step to in this transition if we can apply the new innovative ideas in practice, but how we apply them if there is no connection. It's very important what you
do. That's exactly right. And so I even want to, they have an educational program for youth where I can take some training courses in it, and then I can go and teach the classes to, you know, to children, to get them interested and to understand the linkage, you know, at a very early age, so that they're interested in it going on, progressing through their years. And then, you know, in high schools and in colleges and universities, We're going to be trying to make the different collaborations with industry so that even if you're in high school, you could have a summer job working for a company that's doing this kind of work. And I would say in the next 5 to 10 years easily, today, where we talk about sustainability and there might be a person that has a position of being a sustainable director within a company, I think that that in the next 5 to 10 years, that is going to permeate through the whole organization of the company, so that the people that they're hiring, the young people that they're hiring, will have this thinking already inside of them, the systems approach to everything that they're doing.
Yeah, I think nature does an incredible work, and biomimicry can teach us how we can apply nature's methods in our activities. The first time when I learned about the biomimicry was when I read The Black Economy book by Günter Pauli. And there, the biomimicry has a very important role in Günter's concept. And yeah, I think nature is awesome and so simple and wise at the same time. Could you please tell us some examples how we can apply biomimicry in practice, especially if we speak about buildings?
Well, you know, I can give you a specific example of a project that I worked on, but in a house design, let's say, the architect now will look at ways to use a passive approach towards a challenge, a problem. So let's say on the south side of your house where you get the most sun coming in the windows, rather than having shutters or maybe some kind of window covering on there, they would plant trees in the front of the house so that these trees in the summertime, they would have their leaves, so they would provide a natural shade for that side of the house. And then in the wintertime, the trees lose their leaves and the sun is lower in the sky, but then you want to have that passive solar gain into the house, which is a good thing. So you can see how you're taking advantage of the solar and the site of the house and nature, you know, with trees. That's one way that would be considered maybe a passive design. Another way is something that a project that I worked on where we were, I was brainstorming with a person who was in biomimicry and saying to them, if I wanted to replace a window shade on a window with something that related more to what happens in nature, how could we do that? And he brought to my attention like flowers, certain flowers that, like a sunflower or whatever, that open up with the sun. And then when the sun goes away, they tend to close down like that. So with that kind of mechanism, like you're thinking about that design, then we thought, okay, how could you make that work? So we looked at having a fabric material that would hang in the window, and it would be an open type of material naturally, but it would have a coating on the fabric that would expand with sunlight and then contract when sun goes away. So that way, when the sun comes out, the coating expands, and then it blocks the sun. And even if you get a cloud that comes by in the sun, that material would contract and open up so that you get natural light coming through it again. So that was just kind of the thinking and the process that went behind an actual design project that I actually went through with someone who was in the field of biomimicry. We never really brought it to fruition, and in the end, for I'm not sure for what reason, but that was the approach, the system thinking that we used for that project. There was another area that I learned in biomimicry recently about colors. So for example, if you need to, like automobiles, they can't be remanufactured exactly using the same steel, because the paint, when they put the paint on, the paint, if you to get the colors, the blues and the reds and everything that people want, they have ingredients in them that are toxic, not healthy, but they it affects the strength of the steel. So that when at the end of the life of the car, when you want to use that steel, you can't use it for a car, you have to use it for another application. So that's not good in a circular world. You want to keep products at least on the same, or you want to upcycle them. You don't want to downcycle the stuff. So using biomimicry, they were looking at butterflies, and when you put if they studied the wing of a butterfly under a microscope, there's no color at all there. What happens in a butterfly is the material gets reflected from the light. So the colors that we see are all about the butterfly material reacting to the sunlight, right? So with that same approach now, if we can take the we can replicate the molecules, the molecular design of that butterfly wing, and then apply it, let's say, to paint that goes on a car. So when they're spraying the paint on, it may look like there's no paint at all, but when it gets outside, you've got your color with the light, right?
Right,
And
yeah.
then and then but the best thing is that they can take that car now, the steel, and at the end of that car's life, they can use that steel for another car and infinitely continue to use it for the same upcycle application.
It sounds so great. I hope the industry will apply it. Yes. We talked about the relation between the economic and educational system, and this just came into my mind that there are a lot of awesome and great circular and sustainable ideas and business models, but most of them are or couldn't be applied in practice yet. Because of some barriers like legislations. And my question is, how do you see these barriers regarding the sustainable transition?
Right. So that's a good question. So one of the groups that I had mentioned to you in our correspondence was this group called the Circular Economy Club. And the Circular Economy Club is an excellent club and a group to get to know for anyone out there at any age, because it's a grassroots global movement. I've been part of the group for about 3 years, and it's all volunteers, basically. The headquarters is in London, England, but it's all over the world. And we have a Facebook group, we have a LinkedIn group. The purpose of the group is really to spread the word of the circular economy, to connect people that are practicing in the business and people that are working for companies that are doing it. So we schedule all kinds of events that happen. And one of the events that we do, we've been doing on an annual basis, but I think we're going to do more of them, is something that they call, it's like a hackathon. It's the, I think it's the DIF, the Disruptive Innovation Forum. And it's all online. So it was online before we had the pandemic. So it's going to continue this way. It's the most sustainable way to do things, you know, when you're connecting with people and so on. But these events, I can tell you as a businessman, from that angle, I've learned so much about, you know, from just regular people coming on to these events and talking about their ideas for circular, you know, circular economy. But, you know, that's a huge category, you know, that you can, it's really sustainability. And so, these events, again, sometimes you see businesses coming on, just startups, one or two people coming on to talk about what they're doing. I've seen people come on just with ideas to start something. They want to start a business, or people just with ideas in general. They think it's a great idea to bring to the forum, you know, for discussion. You know, you become a member for free, which just makes you part of the big the worldwide network. And there's lots of social media feeds. There's lots of activity. There's education and training. There's mentorships that can be taken advantage of on there. Myself, I'm actually doing, they just started something called the Circular Economy Institute for Learning. And I've been working in this field for so long, and I don't really have any kind of a certificate for it. So they have certificate programs now, so that I'm actually working on one. And eventually, maybe to become an instructor down the road, so that I could go into a college and maybe teach a program there, or I could go to industry events and, you know, and teach and educate industry on this. Because you know, it used to be, sustainability used to be kind of a nice buzzword, but today it's so important. That everyone has to be, you know, thinking about it and working on it.
Yes, the Circular Economy Club is awesome. Anna Tari, the founder of the Circular Economy Club, I think she makes huge and incredible work. And yeah, she created this platform, which is free, as you said, and gives an opportunity to people from the whole world to connect with each other, to learn more about circularity, because it's a very new topic and it's important to educate ourselves and each other. So yeah, I think it's really cool how the club is works, and I like the way how they communicate, because it makes the people to take an action, not just brainstorming around.
Absolutely. And just something as simple as that, through the Facebook group of the Circular Economy Club, you can just see it's just regular people going on there and talking about regular ideas. Like, for example, the other day I saw something on there, people in, I don't know whether it was Croatia or Serbia, that were taking their old coffee grounds and using it on the ice, you know, to help. I don't know whether it actually melts the ice, but at least it makes it not slippery in the wintertime. So rather than using salt or anything that's not really great for, you know, the environment or for animals to walk in and so on, They're trying to come up with natural solutions, and not only natural, but even better if you're taking waste and turning it into a resource too, right? It's something simple like that. And again, that was on the Facebook group there.
I agree with you that it's very important to turn waste into value and not just look it at as garbage.
Exactly. And on the Circular Economy Club, one last thing I'll just point out is that there's a movie that the CEC sponsored, and it's called 2040, the year 2040. And you can go on and find a preview of that online. But we're officially launching it, I think the screening in April.
What would you say for the listeners where they should start if they want to work with sustainability or circularity?
Getting involved and not being part of the status quo. It's get involved, find ways to get involved. Very simple way of getting involved in this biomimicry whole opportunity. And it's like science, but it's nature. And it's all very basic that we live every day. When we go and walk in the park or in the woods, I like to take my dog for a walk every day, and go slowly and just through the woods, and stop once in a while and see what's happening out in the woods. Like trees, for me, the basic part of nature and ecology, and the best example is a tree. And the way it takes waste, so compared to a human, a tree takes the waste carbon dioxide, which is bad. The trees absorb that for us, and then they output oxygen. They give us back oxygen. How could nature design something better than a tree that takes the waste, absorbs it in, and then gives us, shares with humans, oxygen to live, right? So that's kind of, to me, that's the approach that I like to take. For example, if I'm designing my house today, a lot of people would say, well, I want my house to be net zero. Net zero has kind of become a buzzword where I'm not using fossil fuel energy, I'm using renewable energy, and my I'm my the needs I have for my energy are exactly covered by the good design of my house and the renewable energy that I'm using. So I'm net zero. But net zero, why just be net zero? A tree is not net zero, it's net positive. So when I design my house, I want it to be net positive so that I'm creating more energy in my house than I really need, and I'm putting that back onto the grid for someone else to use, right? So that's really the thinking that I would like to see people try to get to, is that we're not trying to be a little bit less bad every year. Like I think that a lot of people and companies operate that way. It makes them feel better that I'm doing a little bit less bad.
It's still
That's not
bad.
a good thing. That's negative. That's less bad. We don't want to talk about bad. We want to be positive. We want to add positivity, I think, in everything that we do.
Doing more with less, what we already have.
That's exactly right. I mean, what one of the things that got me hooked into the sustainability was when I read this book called Cradle to Cradle. And someone recommended that I read it if I was interested in sustainability. and design, because the guys, the authors of the book were an American architect and a German chemist. The German chemist was someone who worked for Greenpeace, Greenpeace is probably one of the earliest movements on, you know, the environment and trying to protect the resources of the world, like whaling. I guess Greenpeace became very well known initially for helping to protect whales in the oceans. But this book that I bought, as soon as I picked it up, I realized this book is not a regular book. It's not made from regular paper, or it doesn't come from a tree. This book is not a tree. It's something different. And sure enough, it was made from what I go back to these natural polymers that are maybe developed in a laboratory, so that this book could be upcycled and you could make another book or another material with the polymers that the book was made out of. Whereas, why would you take something like that's elegant in nature, like a tree, and make a book from it? Because what happened, first of all, the book is paper, but then you put all of these glues and you put the ink and all of the elements in there that have certain toxic elements in there that aren't good. So you can't make another book out of it. You eventually, when it falls apart or whatever, it goes in the garbage, goes in the landfill. So what a sad story that is, taking the elegance of a tree and making something of it and then throwing it or burning, you know, in the garbage, right?
Exactly.
So I think we have to respect again, the elegance of a simple tree and what it represents and what it brings to us.
Yeah, it's a good example how we can use our knowledge based on nature in a good way. And I know that there is the stone paper technology, which is a bit of similar to this, without chemical bleach, and it's waterproof and washable. If I remember well, is made out of calcium carbonate and biopolyethylene resin, but I'm not sure. And it can be recycled as much as we want it. It's interesting.
Right, so I mean that's an interesting idea, but the thing again is that when we talk of recycling is a tricky term, because you know, you can take plastic bottles and recycle them, but then you have to think about what's the next life that they're being used in, and are you maintaining the value of that material that's in the plastic bottle, so that it can continue to cycle and cycle and cycle. So, because if you're just recycling that plastic bottle into, let's say, material for a park bench, and then what happens at the end of the life of the park bench? I don't know. It keeps on getting downcycled, and eventually it's going to end up in the landfill, in the garbage, because it's losing its value in the material chain. So we like to follow that whole material chain progression, but ideally we have to keep it going up, upcycling it and keeping it going like that.
Bloomakers podcast by MyraBase.com with Osher Wüthem.